Introduce the moderator of our next panel. It's my great pleasure to have here with us today Anne Legacy Dowson, who I've known for over 20 years, since we were both young children. Anne, as many of you know in Montreal, is a journalist. She's a radio host on CJAD, and she's currently Director General of the Anti-Bullying Tolerance Foundation. She's an award-winning broadcast journalist and political analyst, and she appears every weekday morning on CJAD. On Thursdays, she appears on the Radio Canada Premier Political Panel at 10 p.m. She authors Bloke Nation, a weekly column in the Entertainment Weekly Hour. She's a special communications visitor at the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada this year, and that's not to speak of her involvement in politics and so on. I don't know how you do everything that you do. But please join me in welcoming Anne, who will then introduce her panel.
Thank you and good morning. Thanks to Will Straw and the staff of the MISC. It's been a pleasure working with you on this conference. Also wanted to say thank you to Marlene Jennings and to render homage to Greta, who I've long admired. As a graduate in Canadian Studies from another institution, which I will not name, as it turns out it was Carleton, it's a pleasure to be here. And it's also nice to be taking a break from the Gang of Four, much as I love the Gang of Four. Perhaps you're not familiar. You're familiar with the Gang of Four on CJD? Yes. I guess you could say I'm the token left-wing federalist on that panel. But this morning I wanted to introduce you to this panel, which is really a blue ribbon panel of journalists who cover crime and legal affairs, all of whom I think are worthy of your attention if you're not familiar with their work. Betsy Powell is a crime reporter at the Toronto Star and author of a book about Toronto's Galloway Boys, called a book that was called Bad Seed and was described as a look at Toronto the Bad. Specifically the area known as Scarborough or Scarberia and lately Scarlem, some people call it. It's a book about the shooting of two innocent black men by black gang members. Powell herself is from a long line of Torontonians. She's a fourth generation Torontonian. And her father, Clay Powell, was a legend in Toronto, a famous Crown prosecutor involved in many high-profile cases. So it's great to have her here in Montreal just in time for St. Patrick's Day. Marie-Maude Denis is, I guess, la relève, you could call her. She's a rising star in the world of investigative reporting. She is with Enquête and is often seen on screen with Alain Gravel. She's originally from Sudbury, a graduate of Ottawa U. Started in radio in Quebec City, went to NTR, which is the radio service of Canadian Press, and followed Alexandre in the footsteps of Alexandre Dumas, who is a legendary fait divers reporter. Fait divers is often an area covered by men in the tradition of the media. Her career as an investigative reporter started with a brown envelope, that object beloved of investigative reporters. And I suspect she'll be telling us a bit about that. Yves Boisvert, legendary for his modesty, is a legal affairs columnist at La Presse, a graduate in law and études françaises at l'Université de Montréal, chroniqueur judiciaire après avoir couvert diverses campagnes électorales et référendaires. His column in La Presse is mandatory reading for those people interested in the law and legal affairs. He's also heard on Radio-Canada and on various other broadcast networks, and he has a wonderful blog if you're inclined to read the media online. Il est un incontournable. And Julian Scher, ex of the Fifth Estate, is now a freelance investigative writer for The Globe and The Star. He has set up a really important website called Journalism Net, which trains people in the use of the web as an investigative tool, which is now the sort of the new frontier of journalism, is using data banks and using the web to source stories. He's the author of 5 books, White Hoods, the Canadian Ku Klux Klan, Until You Are Dead, the story of Stephen Truscott's, the subtitle is Stephen Truscott's Long Ride into History. He's co-written a couple of these books with Bill Marsden of the Gazette, and the titles are very catchy. The Road to Hell, How the Biker Gangs Are Conquering Canada, Angels of Death, Inside the Biker's Global Crime Empire, and One Child at a Time, The Global Fight to Rescue Children from Online Predators. He's won multiple prizes, including the DuPont Columbia Award, the Pulitzer of Broadcasting, for a piece he did for the New York Times and CBC TV called Nuclear Jihad. He's a graduate of McGill, born and raised in Montreal, and he's the former president of the Canadian Association of Journalists. And I just was on a panel with Julian not too long ago. His mother is a survivor of the Holocaust and a wonderful speaker in her own right. So there you have the panel, and I wondered what I suggest we do is start with Betsy, and then go to Marie-Maude, and then Eve, and then Julian. Some of them have multimedia and audiovisual aids to present this morning. And I was going to ask you, Will, just in closing, how can we turn off our phones if you want us to tweet?
Turn off the sound, check.
Okay. So, and the Twitter hashtag, if those people who are interested in that, is, what do you call that? #MISCANCRIME. And I know there are a number of people following. Right. 1C, MISCAN crime. Okay. So I would like to ask Betsy Powell to start off.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here not only to participate on this crime reporting panel, but also to make a presentation about a subject I feel passionate about. And since it's normally my job to ask questions and listen, it's something of a treat to share some thoughts and, frankly, some grumbles about the state of crime reporting in 2012 from the perspective of someone on the crime and courts beat at a daily newspaper. For the past 4 years, I've been based out of the Star's Courts Bureau. That's that accommodation right there at downtown Toronto's Superior Courthouse. I primarily cover criminal cases and trials, but before that, for a number of years, I was on the crime beat, which also meant working outside the newsroom, going to crime scenes and often filing stories. Sorry, that's the there from that building. That's Toronto Police headquarters, although I noticed it still said Metropolitan Toronto Police, but anyway. We had an office inside the building, incidentally, and a number of other media outlets did as well, but that doesn't exist anymore, which is unfortunate. When I was there, the Star's office was one of several occupied reporters working for other mainstream media outlets, though few maintained a daily presence there. Each office was connected to the room where news conferences were held, often by homicide detectives. That room was named in memory of the late Jocko Thomas, an institution in Toronto, and the Star's main police reporter for 50 years. I can't explain why he was a police reporter and I was called a crime reporter. They seem interchangeable at the paper, where crime coverage also goes in and out of favor. When Jocko was writing stories about cops and crooks, he typed his stories on an Underwood typewriter and wore a fedora. When I was quite young, I can remember hearing him on the radio, a station my grandparents tuned into. Jocko had a distinct sign-off. This is Jocko Thomas of the Toronto Star reporting to CFRB from police headquarters. Did the R rolling thing. That building on Jarvis Street was raised years ago for a condo tower, but it was somewhere I would go on occasion as a kid with my dad, who was in the 60s and 70s, was prosecuting some of the biggest criminal cases of the day. He was also a crime reporter for the Toronto Telegram he was at law school, as an aside. At his retirement, Jocko said he could never go stale on the police beat because there's something different or surprising every day. While he didn't love every day on the beat, he reckoned 95% of his days were pretty darn good. These days, I'm probably closer to about 80%, and that's not because crime is any less interesting, different, or surprising. By way of explanation, what I thought I would do is tell you about things I love and things I dislike about crime reporting today, in keeping with the themes we're trying to of this plenary session. I'll start with a dislike. Sensationalism and shallow knee-jerk crime news and court reporting that emphasizes spilled tears over context and the over-reliance of police on for information and press release reporting, as David Eby called it yesterday. Don't get me wrong, I rely heavily on many police officers whom I've come to know and trust over the years. What I'm referring to is law enforcement spin. Take the police news conferences to announce large-scale child porn busts. Typically, these projects have a code name, And on a stage will sit any number of white shirts, although you can't really see their white shirts, but you know what, I think you know what I'm saying, listing the number of police agencies involved in the investigation before someone rolls out the unsavory details about the number of arrests and the unfathomably disgusting large number of images. This will invariably come with a plea for more resources. And after the nightly newscasts and the next day's headlines, and now it's that day's headlines on the web, the whole sordid business will fade from view. Rarely is there any follow-up by media outlets. How many convictions resulted? And what if one of the accused has his charges withdrawn? I heard from such a man who had lost his job, swore to me a postage-sized stamp child porn image had appeared on his computer while surfing porn sites. He seemed intelligent, nice, and funny. I wrote a story and talked to experts about the possibility that the cops could get it wrong. I don't know if they did or they didn't. But for that man, it didn't matter. He didn't get his job or life back, and the die was cast. I found out he'd committed suicide reading the obituaries sitting up north on a sunny summer weekend. That's one example of why I'm down around 80%. And since I'm on a downer, Jane Kreba, Yonge Street, Boxing Day, 2005. I was working that day down at the Star's office at 1 Yonge Street, and I actually spent most of it watching video clips of young black men rapping and waving what appeared to be guns in the air. It was to be evidence at an upcoming trial. My shift ended, and I left the Star and walked up Yonge Street, went into the Guess store just north of Dundas to try on a pair of jeans I didn't need. The music was blaring so loudly I didn't hear the gunshots that killed a pretty 15-year-old who loved green apples. The story was huge. My cousin, who lives in southwestern Ontario, told me he'd been there. He meant he'd stood or shopped or knew that intersection. There's huge political fallout. It doesn't come across very good. Police, the guy who was on the night shift, Henry Stank, who was also, I think, he was across the street at Sam returning record or CD. So I think he got that shot, doesn't come across very clearly. But so there was huge political fallout and policy making. More cops, more crowns, the province said in response. Stephen Harper's law and order agenda had traction, and the Tories formed a minority government. Can anyone really think crime reporting doesn't affect policy decisions? Apparently, yes. The Ryerson Review of Journalism features a thoughtful piece on crime reporting in its recent issue. Listen to what a colleague said when asked whether she thinks crime reporting changes what the public thinks or politicians do. Quote, she vehemently doesn't know, unquote, the student journalist wrote. Then she quoted the reporter. I don't cover politics, so I don't report thinking about the political implications. And I don't cover the political side of crime either. I cover the crime scene. I don't cover what the politicians are saying about crime. The Ryer student concluded her article saying she contends it's rarely an election issue and low on the political agenda anyway. The reporter apparently was paying no attention during the last provincial election campaign, that slide's not from that, when the Ontario Tories announced they would put names and addresses of 14,000 registered sex offenders online and attach GPS bracelets to their ankles. In the preceding weeks, there had been media coverage of local hysteria about a female sex offender living in Leamington, a small town in southwestern Ontario. When the Tories traveled there on the campaign trail, Conservative leader Tim Hudak told parents the rights of registered sex offenders to privacy should take a back seat to a parent's right to know if they live nearby. There was no mention that a publicly available registry might send sex offenders into hiding, spark possible vigilante action, or the fact that the overwhelming majority of sex offenders know their victim, say nothing of the enormous cost of conducting electronic surveillance on 14,000 people. The Star's reporters covering the campaign were too busy reporting on the horse race and latest poll, so I offered to do a reality check, which the paper ran. And that's when I really like my job, when I can do something like this. I'm not knocking my political colleagues. They wouldn't have had the time mid-campaign to dissect a policy announcement from the road. I have some experience in that regard. When I worked for Canadian Press, I was on the campaign buses covering the 1995 Ontario election campaign that brought Mike Harris's common sense revolution to Ontario. So something I do also love about my job is it's opened my eyes to a part of Toronto we, the mainstream media people, usually only visit when bad things happen. I think it was referred to yesterday as the shadow world that's out of sight. I'll read the my editor and good friend Ken Becker wrote in the foreword to my book. It's, Betsy wasn't interested in writing a book about the 15-year-old girl killed downtown on Boxing Day, the bystander in a shootout between young black kids. It was the exception, the cliche that got the media's juices flowing. She was more interested in the shooting of Brenton Carlton and Leonard Bell a year earlier, the black innocents among many black casualties. Another question our panel is being asked to chew on is the changing economic climate and what it means to investigative reporting. Since I'm in the daily grind, I'll speak to that. And I have two examples, I think, to, which also relate to why I'm not a, always up at 100% and why my job's down at, job satisfaction is about 80%. Part of the changing realities at newspapers, we all are all being asked to do more for less, and part of that means beat reporters covering weekend and night shifts. So it was last year when I showed up to work alongside my very experienced colleague, Peter Edwards, who's written a number of books on organized crime. You show up to the assignment desk, and what's going on? Well, the young editor informed us that York police had charged a young woman with first-degree murder of her mother and attempted murder of her father. And could Peter and I, you know, get the story, and perhaps that we should get on to Twitter and see if we could break it open that way? So Peter and I sort of looked at each other, and he went on to Peter got a source on the phone, and we had the whole story in the paper in the next day. More recently, last week, in fact, Toronto Police issued a press release saying they were having an afternoon news conference to announce details of human remains that had been found. Everyone assumed it was a missing teenager. I was in our courts bureau and got an email, and they asked, one of the editors said, could I find out in advance, so this is about 11 o'clock, the news is at 1, if indeed it was the missing girl. I made a call and confirmed it was. And the Star got to be the first to report that, because being first, even within seconds, is the all-important thing in the digital age. About an hour later, I got an email from the editor quoting the intern asking, how does she do that? She wants to be Betsy. I told her she can be me as long as I can be 25 again. Thank you very much for your attention.
A little snapshot of what it's like to actually cover the crime beat. Thanks, Betsy. Our next speaker is Marie-Maude Denis, and then we'll proceed to hear from Yves and Julian. Marie-Maude. And some of the presentations seront en français, donc voilà. Et les questions aussi, la période de questions sera dans les deux langues.
Just like mine, good morning, et je vais vous demander votre indulgence parce que je vais faire ma présentation en français. Ça va être étrange parce que c'est la fille des journaux qui a un support visuel et c'est la fille de la télé qui en a pas. Donc, je vous remercie d'être ici ce matin, et je vous regarde dans la salle et je regarde le panel, et vraiment, c'est un honneur pour moi d'être ici. Parce que on semble donner au reportage judiciaire, aux faits divers, au crime reporting, vraiment toutes ces lettres de noblesse, tant par la qualité de l'assistant ce matin dans une grande institution de savoir qui est McGill, que par la qualité du panel, qui sont, à mon avis, des journalistes qui ont donné beaucoup de profondeur à ce genre journalistique-là. Et ultimement, c'est parce que c'est vraiment d'intérêt public, le journalisme judiciaire. Et c'est pas évident, Betsy faisait allusion, dans certains médias, et je peux vous dire très candidement que c'est le cas à Radio-Canada, on regarde parfois l'actualité judiciaire, le crime reporting, comme étant un genre dont on peut pas complètement se passer, mais qui est pas un genre parfaitement édifiant de journalisme. Et j'ai toujours dit que les gens qui pensaient comme ça avaient tort, parce que au-delà du crime, il y a ce qui cause le crime, et ultimement, il y a le processus judiciaire, donc la justice, une question tout à fait d'intérêt public. Moi, j'ai commencé sur une note plus personnelle à couvrir les faits divers alors que j'étais un bébé journaliste à Québec. Et puis, vous savez, c'est un feu, big wow, un meurtre, who cares. Il fallait parfois se battre pour être dans le bulletin télévisé du soir, en faisant valoir des arguments que, au-delà du fait d'actualité qui arrive spontanément, il y a un sens plus profond à ce genre d'événement-là spontané. Et lorsque j'étais journaliste à Québec, j'ai commencé à couvrir le Palais de justice de Québec. Pas parce que ça m'intéressait spécialement, mais parce que j'étais la dernière rentrée, puis personne voulait couvrir ça dans la salle des nouvelles. Alors, à ma grande surprise... Ah, puis entre nous, c'est parce que je voulais avoir un bel horaire de semaine, comme les juges aussi, donc j'ai sauté sur l'occasion. Alors, j'ai découvert ce monde aride, rempli d'avocats, rempli de noms de procédures en latin. Un monde où encore en 2012, malgré qu'on répète que la justice est publique, les médias doivent encore se battre pour avoir pleinement accès aux tribunaux et pouvoir diffuser l'information et diffuser les histoires qui s'y déroulent. Mais j'ai découvert qu'au-delà de cet aspect très aride de la justice, c'est un buffet all you can eat de bonnes histoires. Alors, j'ai fait quelques années de reportage dans le Palais de justice avec mon bureau dans le Palais de justice et je suis arrivée à Montréal où j'ai recommencé le beat des feux big wow et des meurtres who cares. Alors, en 2008, grâce à une source que j'avais développée sur le terrain, en couvrant l'actualité criminelle tous les jours, j'ai reçu le fantasme de tout journaliste, une enveloppe brune. Une enveloppe brune qui contenait des informations très sensibles, qui nous projetait dans un monde de la construction au Québec où il y avait plusieurs indices de malversation. Avoir une enveloppe brune, c'est pas comme un billet automatique pour se rendre en onde dans les prochains 24 heures. Ça nous a pris des mois à l'équipe d'enquête pour sortir la première histoire d'une série, une toute petite histoire. Alors, c'est l'histoire du grand directeur du plus gros syndicat de la construction au Québec qui fraudait sur ses comptes de dépenses au restaurant. Alors, il allait au restaurant... Disons qu'il y avait une addition de 10 $, ben il rajoutait 100 $, forgeait la signature de la serveuse et se faisait rembourser par son syndicat. Alors, on a réussi à prouver qu'il avait fait ça pour des dizaines de milliers de dollars et ça aurait pu être une anecdote, une simple anecdote, une fraude dans un syndicat. Mais ce qu'on a découvert, c'est que ce même dirigeant syndical avait des liens avec des figures hyper importantes du crime organisé, tant des Hells Angels que de la mafia. Sachant cela, on a continué de gratter et là, il y a plein d'histoires qui sont nées de ça. Alors, une histoire qu'on a sortie qui a été vraiment le déclencheur de plusieurs autres, c'est qu'on a révélé une autre anecdote. C'est-à-dire que le grand président de la plus grosse centrale syndicale au Québec, la FTQ, Michel Arsenault, avait été passer ses vacances sur le luxueux yacht du plus gros homme d'affaires de la construction, Tony Accurso, un multimillionnaire. Ensuite, la presse a sorti que Frank Zampino, qui est le numéro 2 à l'époque de la ville de Montréal, a lui aussi été passer ses vacances sur le même luxueux yacht. Mais attention, il l'a fait au moment où Montréal s'apprêtait à donner le plus gros contrat de son histoire, le contrat des compteurs d'eau, à ce même homme d'affaires de la construction. Et après ça, ça a généré tellement d'histoires. On a pu aborder des sujets qui sont devenus vraiment la pierre angulaire de l'actualité au Québec dans à peu près tous les médias. Donc, je vous les nomme en vrac. On a exposé avec les autres médias la collusion dans le système d'appel d'offres public, le trucage de contrats de construction. On a parlé de corruption à Revenu Canada. On a parlé de proximité troublante entre les grandes firmes de génie conseil et le pouvoir politique. On a parlé de surfacturation pour les travaux de construction. Et donc, d'une petite fraude de restaurant, on a soulevé une pierre qui est devenue, qui a permis au débat public de s'enrichir de tous ces nouveaux faits-là, qui étaient plus ou moins connus du grand public, et puis qui sont devenus ce qu'on appelle désormais le scandale de la construction au Québec et qui ont mené à une commission d'enquête publique. Alors, je peux vous dire que moi qui viens de couvrir les feux, who cares, puis les meurtres, so what, je suis pas peu fière que d'une simple histoire de faits divers, on a réussi à amener dans le débat public des questions vraiment fondamentales et entraîner des réformes majeures dans la façon dont les contrats sont octroyés au Québec. Et c'est pas terminé parce qu'il va y avoir la commission Charbonneau qui vont certainement entraîner tout un autre train de réformes. Donc, pour en revenir à la couverture du genre journalistique, je vous disais, cette enveloppe brune que j'ai reçue dès le départ, ce tuyau-là que j'ai reçu, je ne l'aurais jamais reçu si je n'avais pas développé d'excellentes sources sur le terrain. Et en ce moment, les médias du Québec, et je pense que c'est le cas aussi partout, doivent se battre pour protéger leurs sources. On a tenté de forcer mon collègue Alain Gravel à révéler ses sources devant le tribunal, ce qui a été refusé. Notre collègue Daniel Leblanc du Globe and Mail s'est battu jusqu'en Cour suprême pour protéger ses sources. En ce moment, il y a une enquête de la Sûreté du Québec pour découvrir le nom des sources qui ont dévoilé des informations confidentielles dans le cadre d'une enquête sur une taupe au SPVM. Il y a eu une perquisition de la police hier chez un journaliste du Journal de Montréal. Donc, c'est encore un combat pour les journalistes de protéger leurs sources. Et les sources de qualité sont celles qui permettent au public d'avoir les vraies histoires, d'avoir leur juste. Parce que si vous appelez un service de relations publiques de la police, et Betsy en a fait tout à fait allusion, if you ask them the time of the day, they might answer that it's part of an investigation and it's very top secret and confidential. Alors, c'est la réalité à laquelle on fait face. Oui, le changement de modèle économique dans les médias affecte la couverture des faits divers. Et je ne suis pas certaine, et je vais avoir des propos peut-être surprenants, je ne suis pas certaine que c'est complètement à notre désavantage et au désavantage de l'intérêt public, parce que plusieurs médias, voyant qu'ils se concentraient et qu'il y avait une compétition pour avoir le Daily Grind en premier, plusieurs médias ont décidé de se distinguer et d'investir dans le journalisme d'enquête pour créer un produit qui est plus distinctif, qui est plus unique et donc qui va attirer les auditeurs et les lecteurs. Est-ce que la politique affecte la couverture des crimes judiciaires? C'est sûr, parce que dans la police, il y a de la politique en masse. Et évidemment, le discours officiel policier va être affecté par la politique. Ils sont toujours en train d'essayer de sauvegarder leur budget ou d'en avoir plus. Et on a recueilli de nombreux témoignages à l'effet que telle déclaration des policiers ou telle autre, ou ce qu'on n'a pas dit lors d'une conférence de presse, avait été un peu téléguidée par ce qu'on appelle « en haut à Québec ». Et j'aimerais vous dire à ce propos-là aussi que c'est pas seulement la politique qui affecte la couverture journalistique, mais c'est aussi la couverture journalistique qui est instrumentalisée par les politiciens. Lorsque on a déclenché une commission d'enquête sur la construction au Québec, les gens m'arrêtaient dans la rue pour me faire des high-fives et me dire « tu dois être contente, enfin t'as mis à genoux le gouvernement » parce que les thèmes qu'on a présentés ont été beaucoup récupérés par l'opposition. Les journalistes n'ont fait pas de politique. Si ça donne une commission d'enquête parce que c'est ça que le peuple veut et ça, c'est ça que le peuple demande, c'est une chose. Mais on tente beaucoup de récupérer les reportages journalistiques pour faire de la politique. Donc, c'est en ce sens que je vois l'interaction et j'ai très hâte de débattre avec mes collègues de tout ça tout à l'heure. Merci beaucoup de votre attention.
In connection with what Marie-Maud was just saying, there's a story in today's edition of the Gazette, page A3, a piece by René Brumer about a raid on a reporter at the Journal de Montréal. So just to emphasize, underline the point that this is an ongoing struggle. Access to information and getting these stories out is not obvious. I'd like to invite our second last speaker, Yves Boisvert, to take the podium.
Bonjour, merci beaucoup pour l'invitation. Je pourrais reprendre beaucoup des propos de Marie-Maud. La première chose à dire, je pense, c'est d'établir l'importance fondamentale du crime reporting, ou du ce qu'on appelait des fois le police beat, ou en français le fait divers, qui, en français justement, l'expression est un peu un fourre-tout. Qu'est-ce que c'est que le fait divers? C'est tout ce qui rentre dans aucune autre catégorie, y compris les crimes, une souris retrouvée dans une bouteille de coke ou n'importe quelle chose un peu bizarre ou insolite qui peut se présenter dans les nouvelles. Mais il est souvent décrié, et dans des conférences comme celle-ci, il est de bon ton de commencer en disant d'associer le crime reporting avec le sensationnalisme. Et d'après moi, il y a beaucoup plus de sensationnalisme dans bien d'autres secteurs d'information, dans les arts et spectacles, dans le sport, parfois même en politique, où on va... Qu'est-ce que c'est, au fond, que le sensationnalisme? C'est un procédé d'exagération entre la réalité et sa représentation dans un média. Et donc, c'est un écart qui rend presque malhonnête la présentation des faits. Mais cet écart-là est souvent bien moins grand dans le crime reporting. Et when Michael Harris breaks the story about the Boys of St. Vincent, what will eventually be known as the Boys of St. Vincent or the Mount Cashel orphanage in Newfoundland, is it crime reporting or is it social and political? When he writes that there have been great number of victims. There has been a police investigation in the 1970s. There has been a report from the Crown Prosecutor, and there has been a cover-up. Is it a crime reporting? I think it's, in fact, any crime reporting is a social reporting. When you report about women who disappear in downtown East Side, it's crime reporting. But it's much more than that. And if you despise or if you think this is not a very important kind of information, you make a very big mistake. Il y avait au Devoir, je cite le Devoir, mais ça peut arriver à Radio-Canada, ça arrive à la presse, ça dépend des directions, mais il y avait la théorie des grosses histoires. Alors, par exemple, parce qu'il y avait moins de journalistes, et donc ça se voulait un journal plus intellectuel, et donc on allait couvrir le palais de justice, parce que moi j'étais au palais de justice pendant de nombreuses années, dans une salle qui ressemblait à celle que Betsy a décrite tantôt, mais plus en désordre encore, et... Donc, on ne couvrira les procès que dans les grosses histoires. Only when a big story breaks, then you go on the crime scene or at the courthouse and then you rush, but you've never seen a judge live before, what a lawyer can look like or meet with a police officer. So, when you try only to cover the big stories, you don't know how it works. And as Marie-Maud said, you don't have sources. You don't develop a web of sources on the field. And if you don't do the footwork with the small or the medium-sized stories, when a big story happens, you don't know how to get it and how to have to see the other dimensions of it. And then you are caught with only what police officers will tell you. Et c'est ça le piège de regarder de haut la couverture des faits divers. C'est qu'à la fin, vous êtes victime, ou vous êtes, si vous voulez, prisonnier des sources officielles qui sont maintenant partout. Il y a bien plus de relationnistes que de journalistes maintenant. Et donc, l'importance d'être sur le terrain et d'avoir des médias qui couvrent ça. Est-ce que ça veut dire que c'est toujours bien couvert? Non, bien sûr. Mais est-ce que ça veut dire que les médias ne sont pas complaisants? Ils sont très souvent complaisants. Ici, il y a plusieurs conférences de presse, de police qui sont devenues des classiques dans la couverture des médias. À Québec, je ne sais pas, Marie-Maude, si à l'époque tu étais encore à Québec, mais la fameuse affaire de la prostitution juvénile. Et la police de Québec a fait une conférence de presse pour dire que it was the most important investigation in the history of the Quebec City Police Department, and they had just merged with there were many little police departments, and then they had this new big police department, and they had finally one very, very big investigation. There was a juvenile prostitution réseau, and so the police arrived before the press and said, we have full proof evidence, une preuve en béton, and what happened? We cannot tell you the details, but it goes beyond anyone's imagination. Turns out it went beyond this police officer imagination, but I'm not saying this was not a serious case, but the exaggeration didn't come from the media, it came from the police. And first the exaggeration, and then the bombastic way to present the evidence, and many cases just fell, and many cases were withdrawn, and then there was a terrible atmosphere in the whole city, saying that there was a political cover-up, since it was so huge, and many arrestations were to take place, and it didn't happen. Why? So somebody is hiding something to us. So this kind of police manipulation has to be shown for what it is. And if the media are not familiar with police investigation and take for granted anything the police say, it can have a very very terrible effect on the social. À Québec, pendant des années, au moins 2 ans, ça crée une atmosphère absolument pourrie, même au niveau politique, parce que la rumeur était que des politiciens étaient impliqués dans ce réseau, non seulement pour faire le cover-up à propos de leurs amis, mais eux-mêmes comme clients, et ça se répercutait dans les médias, dans certains médias. Donc, l'importance pour les médias de connaître le milieu criminel, de connaître la police et de surveiller la police. En démocratie, si personne surveille le travail de la police, si personne critique ce pouvoir-là, qui est quand même d'utiliser la force et parfois de pouvoir tuer des gens, ben ça va mal. Je le disais tantôt, moi je suis ma formation et mon travail comme journaliste, ça a été beaucoup autour de la justice et des tribunaux. C'est vrai que malgré que tous les discours du monde de la justice sur les rapports avec les médias commencent par des citations classiques sur la liberté de la presse, l'importance de la transparence, du fait que une justice qui n'est pas rendue en public se détériore et se corrompt, et quand arrivent des cas difficiles, mais généralement, la tendance est de dire, on n'a pas vraiment besoin. Est-ce qu'ils ont vraiment besoin d'avoir accès à tel document? Est-ce qu'ils ont vraiment besoin de savoir ça? Et donc, la résistance est permanente dans le milieu de la justice par rapport à l'information. Par contre, je dois dire que même s'il y a eu beaucoup, beaucoup de querelles entre les médias et la justice, les jugements des dernières années, sans être toujours ce que les médias auraient voulu, ont été plutôt encourageant. Daniel Leblanc, il a gagné sa cause en Cour suprême. La protection des sources n'est pas parfaite, mais elle est plus clairement établie qu'elle ne l'était il y a, mettons, 10 ou 20 ans. Mais ce qui est inquiétant en ce moment, c'est je reprendrai l'expression de Marie-Monde, l'instrumentalisation de la justice et de la criminalité à des fins politiques. Et franchement, je me souviens pas d'avoir vu un gouvernement utiliser de façon aussi vicieuse et malhonnête les statistiques, les études, pour tenter de pousser un agenda idéologique. Il est rendu extrêmement difficile d'avoir une conversation raisonnable sur la sécurité publique au Canada. You are either on the side of victims or on the side of pedophiles. You have to choose your camp. Well, thank you. So, when you write about that, when you criticize Bill C-10, you're being told, well, okay, so you don't care about victims. Oh, great. And if it happened to you or your son or your wife, maybe you wouldn't have that same stance. Well, you can have respect and compassion and for the victims at the same time believing in a fair trial, believing in the rights not of criminals but of any citizen. But this government, and I mean, when you have ministers, you have Victaves, you have Senator Boisvenu, who is the unofficial spokesperson for the government on public security matters in Quebec, since Mr. Nicholson and other members of the cabinet don't have a very good French, Mr. Boisvenu is their spokesperson. And when Statistics Canada release its annual report on crime and justice and so on, and that they show that statistically the crime rate is going down in Canada year after year, well, he says, well, somebody is manipulating the data. These people have an agenda. They are criminologists, sociologists, and you know they do something with the data. And this is somebody who was I was to say an elected, but he's not elected. But he is a member of the legislative body of this country. And he attacks not only, he doesn't say, well, sentences should be tougher. He says, no, it's not true. There's more crime. You should not feel, you should be more worried. So every single stupid judgment, and it happens, every too clement decision is taken and is instrumentalized exactly for that purpose, to say, well, we're not safe here. We should defend the victims more, and then we should change our legislation and have a tougher criminal code, and maybe put ropes in the cells, in the prison cells, so that, you know, they might do something with it. So that's very troubling, because it makes our job even more important to explain sentences, to explain the justice system, to explain the notion, explain the notions of, you know, the équilibre. Et en ce moment, l'atmosphère est vraiment à une opposition stupide, malsaine et malhonnête entre les droits des individus. On parle d'une... Quand le sénateur Boisvenu parle de la Charte des droits, c'est la Charte des droits des criminels. Et évidemment, toute personne accusée en est un. Alors, ça, pour moi, c'est en ce moment l'enjeu, un enjeu très, très, très troublant et qui touche les journalistes. Cela dit, au niveau économique, comme dit Marie-Maude, ce qui, en ce moment, le modèle économique des médias est complètement remis en question. On ne sait pas ce qui sera notre avenir dans 5 ans. We don't know if we will be printed in five years from here. We don't know if we'll be only on computers. What we know is that every dollar that goes from the print is divided when it comes to our web platform. So will we have the same amount of money to have newsrooms to do that job? We're not sure, and nobody knows. But what we know is that there is a market for good information, and it forces us to be more relevant than ever and to have something that not everybody who claims to be a citizen journalist can do just by writing his opinion on Twitter or whatever. So we have to redefine ourselves to go to the core of what we are as journalists, and it's to defend the public interest. Merci.
And now Julian Scher.
Give me a moment to set up the computer. Je vais parler en anglais pour créer un certain équilibre sur le panel, mais évidemment, je peux prendre les questions en français. What I want to look at is what I call holding a dark mirror to society. Let me take you back about 15 years. Many of you in the room may remember scenes like this, but aside from the riot we had last night, this is what the streets of Montreal felt like. Whoa. Hold on. Let me get some sound. Give me a moment.
Ça va?
Okay.
In the province of Quebec, there have been few detours on the road to hell. So the Hell's Angels kept on rolling, bombing and blasting their way to power over rival bikers. The number of bodies left in the wake of their battles makes the gang wars of Chicago in the 30s look like a skirmish. In just the past few years, 159 dead, 16 missing, over 200 attempted murders, 82 bombs, 140 cases of arson. In the past 3 years alone, more than 14% of homicides in Montreal, in one way or another, lead back to the biker gangs.
So it's, you know, it's hard to remember those good old days, so to speak. The problem, though, that I want to focus is that when people think about crime reporting, this is what we think about, you know, biker gangs, violence. And I'm somewhat a victim of that. I mean, I contributed it by writing with Bill Marsden two books on the bikers. And even though those books are more than close to a decade old now, and I've written books since then on the Stephen Truscott case, on the Ku Klux Klan, on child abuse, child pornography, and my last book is on juvenile child prostitution, the Hell's Angels books still outsell all my other books together. I still get calls. On Monday I was in Washington. I got calls from Radio Canada, TVA, because of a Hell's Angels arrest in Mexico. So the problem is that even as a serious journalist, if you're trying to move on and do other stuff, you still get dragged back into sort of fait divers, like Hell's Angels. And I think that's a challenge for us as journalists, because you are privileged here to have a blue ribbon panel of journalists who are trying to do not just crime reporting, but serious investigative journalism. But most of the so-called crime reporting that people watch, and it's even worse in the States, trust me, any of you have spent just a night turning on TVs in the States, the problem is that it becomes very superficial, and we're not looking at the real crimes. And that's what I want to focus on. I think the purpose of any good reporting, but particularly crime reporting, is to hold up a dark mirror to society and not look so much at the criminals, but look at what our responsibility. What are we being criminal about? And I think that means you have to investigate the justice system itself, and you have to investigate the social system behind the justice system. That's what real crime reporting is. And I think, as Maddie Moden and even Betsy pointed out, if you think about it, all good reporting, one way or the other, will lead to some form of crime reporting. First beat I think we have to cover more is the injustice system. We cover a lot the justice system. The most famous case, of course, in Canada, pour le Québec, le cas de Stephen Truscott était moins connu, mais c'était un peu comme l'affaire Coffin. So for people who have the same color hair as me, you remember back in 1959, a little girl is found dead. Immediately, a young boy is suspected. And this was the headline. He was wanted dead or alive. At the time when he was arrested, he was quickly sentenced. He was sentenced to hang, and only at the last minute. And when I got hold of the cabinet notes at the time, Diefenbaker commuted the sentence in part because of the embarrassment that Canada was facing about hanging a 14-year-old. That case eventually would help lead to the end of the death penalty. But it took 30 years till the young teenager grew up to be a grandfather and approached us and came to tell his story. But when I met Stephen in 1997, I don't think either of us imagined it would take another decade before our journalism and his work would lead to a resolution of the case. So that's the first thing. We have to do a lot more reporting about the injustice system. Second are crimes that are ignored. We talked about the scandal over juvenile prostitution, and Betsy referenced the bad police conferences on child pornography. That being said, there are cases like these victims. Nobody cares about young prostituted girls. They don't count. We actually don't even have statistics on them, because they don't count for anybody, so nobody's counting them. And look at the statistics, or the minister there talked about Canadian justice. Well, this is Canadian justice on trafficking. Only 30 people have ever been charged with human trafficking. Sorry, only 30 have ever been charged. Only 5 have been convicted in Canada. So either we're the country that has no problem with the trafficking of women, or we have laws that aren't working. An Ontario man got 3 years for marketing one girl. In Montreal, a guy got 1 week in jail. And when he convinced the judge that he'd written a poem and he had, seen a new light, the judge let him off by writing poems, and so he was sentenced for just 1 day. Now, the problem I have as a journalist is when I write stuff like this, as we pointed out, the politicians seize on it and call for tougher sentences. And I think the debate we have is every time I expose an injustice, I have to live with the fact that politicians will deform what I'm trying to say in order to enact legislation that sometimes won't address it. So that's why I think we have to focus on broader issues. We have to look at how we as a society are guilty. We treat these girls as garbage, and yet we promote the pimps. Anybody here who has a teenage son or daughter, you can absolutely be certain they play games like Grand Theft Auto 4, the most popular selling video game, in which one of the key ways you make points is by killing prostitutes. And there are videos on how you can kill prostitutes. You can go on Amazon. You can't buy books about slavery, but you can buy books about how to become a pimp, and with explicit guides about how to manipulate these girls, how to find the girls, how to prey on their weakness. And if you buy any of these books, Amazon will kindly recommend other books on how to become a pimp. So these are the kinds of things I think we have to attack that the government and society are not. And of course, what are the consequences of ignoring issues like this? Well, we saw it in Vancouver. There's a commission going on now, right, in the Robert Picton case, right, where nobody cared, either in the media or the police initially, when just a bunch of Native women were disappearing off the streets of Vancouver, until we realized the consequences of it. Picton said, they got 48 on the list, but the list was like only got half of the people in there, right? So who knows how many people they killed. The third thing I think we have to look at, which is largely being ignored, is what I call junk science in the courts. This is the CSI effect, that jurors and people in the public expect that science can immediately solve anything, and if somebody with a degree after their name or a white lab coat says something, it's got to be true. This case of a woman in Peterborough, Brenda Wadby, was just one of many victims of Charles Smith, the most famous example of justice gone awry, because one so-called child pathologist and expert condemned. Let me just play you a brief video. You'll see what happened to Brenda and how a whole town turned against her.
It is every mother's nightmare. Her baby daughter is found dead, but her anguish is just beginning.
Morning, you're arrested for second-degree murder.
She is accused of the crime. The whole town turns against her.
She was an outcast. The community was appalled.
But she insists she's innocent.
I wanted them to catch the killer. but they thought the killer was me.
This is the heartbreaking ordeal one mother endured to clear her name.
Now, in Brenda's case, because she was a coke addict, she lost her kids, and one of the kids lines up dead, and the scientist said she did it. She spends...
Wadby was someone with a troubled past.
She spends a decade trying to clear her name, and the media jumped on the story as a kind of coke addict mother. Here's what the expert said. And luckily, some of that same media, especially the Toronto Star, began to investigate and began to turn things around and began to raise troubling questions. But it took a decade for that town to turn Brenda Wadby, instead of being seen as a bad mother and the worship of science, for her to become a heroine. And she's actually now got a huge award from the government and has got back control of her kids. So there's an example where the media exploited the role of science. And finally, the question of, I think we have to cover crimes that aren't illegal. I recently did a story for the Toronto Star on organ trafficking. This man bought a kidney. Canadians go abroad. The trial, I wasn't going to miss this conference because he was going to testify today in Kosovo, but the trial has been put off till next week. It's not illegal in Canada. It's illegal to buy an organ in Canada, but it's not illegal for Canadians to go abroad and buy organs from poor people. And so that's not a crime. So does that mean we don't cover it? No, I think we have to cover things that aren't a crime. Finally, what are the consequences of our reporting? Well, first of all, we have to be damn careful. My wife once interviewed a judge, excuse the expression, but she was doing a story on a benefit of the doubt. And this famous judge in Newfoundland turned to the jurors, was trying to explain benefit of doubt. He said, benefit of doubt, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, means you better be fucking sure. Excuse my language, but the point is, as journalists, you know, benefit of doubt doesn't mean having a doubt, it means having no doubt. And there are consequences. We did a story on Alan Ross, one of the biggest cocaine dealers in the 1990s in Quebec, when by the time the story aired, this senior RCMP man committed suicide the day before our report aired. And I always have to live with that. And I have to be damn sure that my reporting is accurate if these are the consequences of somebody's life. But people get punished. We did an expose on warlords and criminals from Somalia, and the government will crack down and sometimes arrest people. But people who do the reporting get into trouble. We just talked about the case. This is the article in today's Journal de Montréal about this journalist whose stuff was seized. We saw the same thing with Juliette O'Neill. We saw it with Daniel LeBlanc. So we are getting punished for the stories. When I did the book on the Hells Angels, the RCMP, instead of investigating the fact that they were screwing up the cases, investigated us instead of investigating the problem. But you also get justice. Stephen Truscott, 10 years after we started investigating, through the work of his lawyers and especially his wife, eventually got a $6 million settlement and was acquitted. And most importantly, I think people get a voice. For me, that's the most important reason why I do crime reporting, is we give voice to the voiceless. We give voice to people who aren't being heard. The most moving things I've had is when I get letters. I got letters from some of the girls who were in the book. So thank you for caring for girls that went through the same thing I went through. I know most people see them as worthless. I would never have thought I'd be featured in a book. I'm glad, though, that it might help other people out. And just last week when I was in Arizona, I got this letter from a girl there. My parents and probation counted me out as another lost hoe with no future. Your book lets people know we are not just girls who choose to sell our body. And I like these words. Thank you for at least trying, she says trying, she doesn't say I did it, to open people's eyes, and then I like these words, to this unknown, unspoken world of child trafficking and what we need from them to escape. So I think that's what our job as journalists is to at least expose your eyes to some of the troubling things and make you realize that the criminals aren't necessarily the Hells Angels. I'm not saying that the Hells Angels aren't the criminals, but the crimes that are being committed are crimes that we as a society commit, and we look the other way. Merci.
Thanks to all our panelists, and I guess this is the public and interactive part of the presentation. I don't know who's going to break the ice. There are microphones, and you're more than welcome to ask questions in either French or English. Shall we start with Will Straw, the director of the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada?
Mais j'aimerais d'abord remercier les panelistes. It was fantastic. This question is for anyone. And it's about whether there are differences between Francophone and Anglophone media in the coverage of crime. We know there's a long history in Quebec of La Presse Jaune, of crime tabloids. We still have Hebdo Police and Photo Police. We don't have Allo Police anymore. Those have disappeared from English Canada for the 30 or 40 years ago. I'm just wondering if you see a difference between the two traditions, if you like, in Canadian journalism.
I think yes, there is a there are many differences, but one of them has been the fact that for many French media and for many years, crime reporting was seen as a, as I said, something that should not be played too hard, and that created a market for those tabloids only on crime. Now, television has put more crime reporting, and newspapers also. But I think that in the Anglo-Saxon tradition, and Julian or Betsy, maybe you can prove me wrong on that, but crime reporting has been more integrated into the mainstream media. I've seen headlines from the 1950s or 60s in the Globe and Mail about bank robbery and stuff that you would not have seen played as big in the mainstream French newspapers, I think. And for instance, the way the Bernardo trial was covered in the newspapers, without trying to be to disguise anything, I think that's more integrated, the idea that it's part of high-quality journalism, it can be, and same thing for the court reporting. And crime reporting and court reporting is not the same. You have, when you're in the court, you're watching one of the branches of government, so... But these two, I think, are more integrated in the tradition of Anglo-Saxon media. But, now you can make 1,000 exceptions on that. But
other panelists?
I think it's a good question. I think traditionally there was a difference, in part what Yves said. The Quebec media and certainly the tabloids were much more similar to what we saw in the States, kind of salacious, and crime reporting was seen as kind of the underclass of journalism. But I think what's now happened is that the French media have surpassed the English media. We were talking before in that, when I was talking with the senior executive at Enquête at the time, at the height of the construction scandals, and he said, is there more corruption in Quebec? Or is it because there are more investigative journalists investigating corruption in Quebec? Yeah. And I think both are true to some degree. But I think what we now have in Quebec that the rest of the country should be jealous of is, Enquête, La Presse, André Noël, Yves columns. There's an attention to justice and police that you don't, and I've worked at the Globe and Mail. I do work now for the Toronto Star. Most journalists in English Canada would be jealous of the amount of space and the money and the attention that the bosses at TV and the newspapers are willing to. So even Journal de Montréal, which should be like the Toronto Sun, in other words, a kind of tabloid, Journal de Montréal is doing investigative journalism, which you don't see at the Sun.
To pick up on you and from what Marie-Monde said, it started from crime reporting. Mm-hmm. And you have to give credit to Enquête and other news media, and La Presse and Le Devoir and so on, for this, the creation of this commission of investigation that the government didn't want. And they created a half commission, and it was so badly criticized that they had to give full power to Judge Justice Charbonneau. But when you think of somebody like André Cédillo, he was, when I arrived at La Presse in 1988, he was, he was covering crime. He was the guy who knew the Hells Angels by their name, or all the other biker gangs, the Popeyes, and so on. But from that, he went to organized crime, seeing a bigger picture. And from that, he went into corruption matters and to political levels. So, but it started with a guy who was covering, you know, a murder in the, or people found dead in the St. Lawrence River after, and then from that he put he connected the dots. Yeah.
If I can add, my parents were very sad for me when I said I was covering the faits divers, and my dad said, "Oh, not the chien écrasé, like this is squash dogs. Can't you call that like fait société or society facts? Because there's a star system in crime reporting in earlier like 80s, 90s with there's like stars from the Journal de Montréal, Michel Ougier, Claude Poirier, who's a legend.
You would have to get shot to get that.
That's okay.
There is a tradition on the French side of reporters getting shot. It happened to Jean-Pierre Charbonneau of Le Devoir. He was actually shot in the newsroom, and later on was in a court room, and he looked over, and the guy who shot him was sitting beside him in the courtroom and was arrested and ended up doing time. And then there's the case of Michel Ougier being shot in the Journal de Montréal parking lot for similar reasons. So, so that's why the reference to being shot.
For the exact same reason.
Yeah. Right.
And this is a group of reporters that covered, like, the Montreal red light in the 60s and 70s. And it's another type of coverage entirely now, I believe.
Betsy, did you want to add anything on this?
I'm jealous.
You're jealous.
Because we get shot? No, not for that. I can't recall any examples of Toronto crime journalists being shot. But also that the resources are being dedicated. And I mentioned in my presentation that crime coverage goes in and out of vogue at the Star. And it's maybe Julian would disagree, but I think it's not in vogue. And so it's sort of toil and weigh, and you write stories about what's going on in the courts, and I'm usually allotted about 10 inches in the back of the GT section, and I think it's really important. I think it's a rare opportunity to hear. There's a witness that I covered earlier this week. He's on trial for first-degree murder for killing someone who had testified against him 2 years ago. I mean, this is something we hear a lot about, the code of silence, and here's someone who actually did, according to the Crown, pay the price for breaking the code of silence, and I'm the only one sitting in the courtroom, although my colleague Peter Small stepped in yesterday.
Hmm. Okay. Question over here.
My name is Sam Tota. My question is on the terminology of crime reporting. I misunderstood it. And you gave a definition of crime reporting from the point of view of reporters. I wanted to hear the crime reporting from the side of the public, that means the people. I went to an old people's home, and one woman stated to me she lost $1.5 million and not reported. So my question is, what state is our institutions, the infrastructure, that the people that lose money, and today we know many stories. I won't talk about Madoff in the States, but we have small Madoffs in Canada. And how is it that the public, the people, can come forward and tell their stories and go through it? And that's my question would be to Madame Denis, who was in the court system, Le Palais de Justice, where you don't see a single lawyer to give information to the public. When you walk in and you have a letter from a sheriff or some official status and you walk in to get information, you cannot get it. How is it possible that in a Palais de Justice where you have 10,000-15,000 people working and not a single one, an official one, to give you information? That's my question, the infrastructure of the system.
Okay.
Allez-y.
Answer. Préférez-vous que je vous réponde en français ou en anglais? Okay, sans importance. Vous avez dit deux choses. First of all, I think I understand that You say that it's very important that reporters talk about fraud, and I believe since the Vincent Lacroix story in Quebec that media and police, which is the most important part of this, are way more sensitive to white-collar crime and frauds. And before, in a, je vais poursuivre en français, si vous permettez. Avant, dans la police, il y avait comme les gens qui travaillaient sur le crime organisé, qui étaient des vrais policiers, et ceux qui travaillaient les crimes économiques, c'était des pousseux de crayons qui étaient des perçus comme pas des vrais policiers, qui étaient perçus à peu près comme inutiles. Et la sensibilité du public a beaucoup évolué pour les crimes de col blanc, parce que c'est tout le monde, c'est ma mère, c'est votre frère qui est victime de ces fraudeurs-là, et ce sont les victimes de ces fraudes-là qui ont sensibilisé les journalistes à ça, qui ont raconté les histoires, parce que si on avait attendu des procès et la conclusion de procès avant de découvrir ces histoires-là, on attendrait sûrement encore. Vous avez mentionné l'aridité des palais de justice, l'accessibilité à la justice, le fait que ça coûte à peu près 200-300 $ de l'heure payer un avocat pour même pour répondre à des questions très simples. Je suis d'accord avec vous. Et lorsqu'on parle de l'aide aux victimes, et Yves a fait mention de ou bien vous êtes avec les victimes, ou bien vous êtes avec les pédophiles, il y a quelque chose qui n'est pas fait en ce moment dans notre système de justice, et c'est d'assister tous les justiciables, que ce soit les victimes, les proches de victimes, tout ça, parce que ça coûte cher, offrir des travailleurs sociaux à des personnes qui ont été victimes d'un crime. Parce que la réalité en ce moment, c'est que moi, j'ai beaucoup d'appels de gens qui disent, écoutez, mon ex-conjoint a été arrêté il y a 3 ans, il a été remis en liberté, le procès va être dans 2 ans. Je fais quoi, moi, dans ma vie, avec la garde de mes enfants? J'appelle les enquêteurs, ils ne veulent pas me répondre. Je vais au palais de justice, je ne sais pas à qui demander. Personne ne peut me répondre. Vous soulevez un très bon point, monsieur, que l'information de base sur la justice, il y a un manque. Il est difficile à obtenir, il y a un manque à ce niveau-là.
Merci beaucoup.
We'll go over to this microphone.
My name is Michael Jackson. I'm a professor of law from UBC. One of the questions I've got, principally to Julian, but the rest of the panelists as well, Canada in the next decade and thereafter is going to be relying upon imprisonment more than we have done so in a century as a result of BC or C10. Julian talked about holding up a dark mirror, and he talked about the injustice system, and he talked about the unknown world, and he talked about giving people a voice who don't have it. Those in the deep end of the criminal justice system, particularly people in federal penitentiaries, and in Quebec you have the only super maximum security institution in the country here, is there not a responsibility on journalists to start focusing more on what is a really difficult job of reporting of what happens behind prison and the damage that is done and the injustice that experienced, so that people in understanding the criminal justice system and actually interrogating governments on the use of imprisonment have a real understanding of what is happening in their name in a mirror which they should be using to look at what kind of justice system they want.
I think it's a very good point. Howard, there actually is the federal... back there, Howard.
Who are you waving at, Julian?
The man over there, just want to... that's right. He's... the gentleman over there is actually a little-known hero in Canada. He is the... His mandate is to be the federal oversight in on prison cares, and he played a key role in the Ashley Smith revelations. I think you raise a very good point. The joke I always tell is you can go on the website, some American websites, particularly Florida, and do a search for blue-eyed Hispanic women over 50 charged with drug crimes if you were trying to find somebody, and you'll get a complete criminal records, pictures of them and when they're going to be released. And that if you go to the Federal Corrections Service here in Canada and ask to do an interview with a journalist, with a criminal, they will, somebody who's in jail, a prison inmate, they won't even confirm or deny that that person is in prison. So that's the difference in terms of openness. I think look at the stories that we're not reporting on, AIDS in the prison system, needle exchange programs, gangs in the prison system. We were talking last night about the native population and now the increasing minority non-white population in the prisons. So these are stories that are not being done, and frankly, part of the problem we would have, I think Betsy would agree and the others, is that these are hard stories to sell to your editors, right? Because, you know, who's going to care, right? They're in prison. They obviously did something wrong. I'm not even talking about the wrongly convicted, the people who are convicted of various crimes. And I think it's our job as journalists is to do unpopular stories. But they're tough sells. They're hard to sell to our bosses. They're hard to get the money.
Tougher than if you find a gymnasium that has cost much, too much, you know, and that the idea, anything that reinforces the idea that you're so well-treated while you're in prison, that's a good story.
You know? Now, recently, I don't know if you saw it, New York Times this week had a great story on the prisons in Mexico, in Costa Rica, because of the fires that were there. The New York Times also had a great story recently how Mississippi, you know, no liberal state, shut down its isolation ward and found out that violence in the prison actually went down. I know the Globe and a couple of other media have been trying to hold to account the government about the crime statistics, but I agree. I think there's a whole story behind those walls.
Julian, the access to this world is not a small problem to cover. There's a bunch of laws of confidentiality issues, and it's very, very hard to get real information about what's going on. So it's not a small problem. You're talking about the interest, but it's not easy to investigate in this field.
The joke that I heard when I was in Winnipeg was that the conservative government's approach to the native housing problem was to just build more prisons, because so many of those incarcerated are First Nations people. And this is a joke told to me by somebody who works with street people and homeless people in Winnipeg. Sorry, so we'll just go to the next mic.
Hi, thank you very much for a fascinating presentation. I was wondering, I'm a law student here at McGill taking sentencing at the moment, and I was wondering, in some cases, judges actually take into account the amount of media attention an accused or an offender who's convicted has received in deciding the sentence. And I was wondering if you could share your thoughts on the legitimacy or illegitimacy of this.
It's une arme à double tranchant. Because as Justice Leroux Dubé said, if you're in a public position, you benefit from that in many ways. So you will fall from a higher ground and it will hurt more. So it is normal that if you are in a position of public trust, you will be covered more. You know what I mean? If you're head of the narcotics squad in the Montreal police, you're in a very, very sensible, very important position. If you get caught trafficking drugs, taking drugs, this is the Marchesso case. If you're taking drugs from the police voûte and sell that, you might argue, and she, like she said when she was in the Court of Appeal, that you should get a tougher sentence because you're in a position of public trust. Then the fact that the media covered that very much, I think, is not relevant. I think it can be relevant in the case of somebody who is unknown and that there has been exaggerated coverage. I think it can be relevant. It depends on the case. It depends what that person had as the position of that person, the idea of public trust. But Normally, if you get a lot of media coverage because you are known, just because the fact that you are a celebrity, or it should not get you give you a break, because from that position you add advantages also. So it goes both ways.
I saw there was a case, I think it was 2 years ago, where a guy drunkenly got on stage with Oasis, the UK rock act, and I think he maybe pushed Noel Gallagher. He was arrested. Anyway, it was a huge story, of course, because the incident was caught by somebody and was posted on YouTube. When it came time for sentencing, we were at Old City Hall, and the judge did take into account that this guy, he'd been sort of terrorized by media, and, you know, as a fellow human being, I thought it was the right decision to take that into account. And plus, when you heard the background about the troubles the guy'd had and things that had resulted because of his exposure in the media, I felt the judge did the right thing.
And if I could add that people who are the object of an intense media coverage, sometimes it's the difference between keeping your job or your employer being scared by the media pressure letting you go. So there is more consequences to a crime for a person who is the object of intense media coverage. Does that mean that he should be given a break? I don't know. I think it's a case-by-case thing.
We're just coming up against the clock. Maybe one last question.
Hi. I'm from Brazil, and I work as a crime reporter there. And sometimes I felt that I was in danger because I'm not a police officer, but I felt like I was doing some police work, some investigation, etc. So my question is, how do you see the boundaries between being a journalist and being a police investigator, something like that?
That's a big question.
This one should go to Julian.
That's a very good question. And it works both ways. You know, when I met Stephen Truscott, you know, I said, if you want to prove yourself innocent, go get a lawyer. That's not my job, right? My job is to investigate, and if it lands up, we find evidence that you're innocent, that's where we'll go. So you have to make that clear, right, even when you're trying to expose injustice. It's the same thing with the cops. I would literally find myself in a situation where I'd be meeting with a cop, and he said, are you going to go see that Hells Angels leader later on? I was in Winnipeg, and I said, yes. And he said, well, could you pass on this message to him? So, you know, because they were...
Sure.
So, and I said, sure, as long as it wasn't, you know, and so you play that difficult role.
You did it. You passed on the message.
Well, it wasn't written. He was just, can you tell, you know, it was like.
Tell him to be at court at such and such a time. No.
So I, you know, and sometimes the bikers might tell, you know, so it's a very difficult role, right? And your nightmare is to get involved in a case either as a witness or, so I think you have to tread a very, very strict line, you know, and it means I don't cozy up to the cops. They don't see me as their PR person, but I don't chum around with the bikers and denounce the cops and try to help them either. And they have to know that, you know, that I have to walk a very, very narrow line. But it is not easy. Now, if it means something that I write puts somebody in jail, well, that's not up to me. I just have to write what we find. But it is very, very uncomfortable. Increasingly uncomfortable. And one of my friends discovered that he was meeting with a cop, they were exchanging information, and the police were reporting on him as a source, you know, source number, you know, because we'll often, and there is an exchange. I have to give information to get information.
They don't tell you that you have a code number.
That's right. And so maybe I am coded, I don't know. And then I have to give the bikers or any other criminals information in order to get back information. I think you face in Brazil or Mexico now, we're looking at the journalists there, literally face death. So the courage of our Latin American and Central American colleagues is much more severe. But this, it's a very uncomfortable position for journalists to be in, and we just have to try to, you know, walk a very narrow line.
I can tell you that when Michel Auger got shot 5 times in the back, I remember very clearly that day, we didn't feel very... comfortable.
You know? No.
We were frightened. I mean, it cannot happen. His last paper was about bikers, and nobody has been accused of that crime, but police thinks or knows that it came from a very specific biker or a gang. And he didn't uncover something, he didn't disclose anything, and there's that kind of unwritten law that if you just report on public cases or police information that anyways will eventually end up in court, you're not supposed to get, but it happened that, fortunately it didn't happen since then, but I mean, it's a miracle that he didn't die from that. And more incredible, a few months after, he resumed writing about bikers and so on. And if you meet him, you couldn't tell that he was. I think we were more afraid than him. But
he didn't want to come on today's panel, though. I tried to get him.
No, but it's time for maple syrup.
He wants to do
season.
Other things.
Just a little. I could just add a little anecdote. The reason he actually got 6 bullets in his chest, and there was actually a 7th bullet, but it missed. And the reason Michel is alive today is the killer is in the parking lot and put the gun in an umbrella, right, to fire the gun against Michel. He was very close, and the police and Michel figured that the tip of the umbrella. He was aiming for Michel's head, but the tip of the umbrella forced the bullets down, so they all went into his chest. So it may have been that umbrella that saved Michel's life.
Okay, well, on that rather harrowing note, I guess we should close off because I think it's official time for break. But I would like to thank very much the panel. That was a wonderful series of presentations, and I feel like I learned a lot from all of you. Yves Boisvert, Julian Cher, Marie-Maude Denis, and Betsy Powell. And I guess you can accost them as they descend from the stage. Thank you very much to all of you. Super interesting morning. Merci. Merci beaucoup.